Greetings, everyone. You're with Norm Schultz, Chalmer Wren, and I'm Nick Urkus. This is the Mile High Sanity Project, and you're in it. Well, welcome once again, everyone. It's the Mile High Sanity Project coming at you. We're looking at cosmos again. And you know, folks, if you ever really considered visiting another planet, you probably thought to yourself, man, I'm going to need a bigger boat. Because the problem with space is that there's an awful lot of it, and it takes a long time to get anywhere. But, as Doc Brown would have told you, you're just not thinking fourth dimensionally. Because it turns out, conveniently, if you want to visit another planet, all you got to do is dig. Just dig real deep. Because, Norm, the Earth of the past is another world.
It is. Good morning.
So, I'm here with Norm Schultz and Chalmer Wren.
Hello.
And I am the aforementioned Nick Urkus, and we're talking Cosmos Episode 9, The Lost Worlds of Planet Earth.
Lost Worlds. Makes me think that the episode was going to go the direction of Jules Verne or something like that.
Yeah, but I actually really like the way it went.
I love this episode. Like every episode, I love this one.
I enjoyed it, but it wasn't as good as others to me. But I was not unhappy with it. It just wasn't as inspiring to me. It got a little bit preachy, which I'm fine with for the audience, you know. But I've heard a lot about all that stuff already. So
I've heard about most of the stuff that was in this episode. So this one didn't have a lot of new information necessarily, but there were things. What the series does I love is connect dots for me in a way that I hadn't done previously. So there are a few things in here that kind of blew my mind just because I had never thought about them, even though they are things that I already knew independently of each other.
There are a few components that I wasn't aware of or had forgotten. The beginning was one of them for me, the huge insects.
Yeah, it's crazy, isn't it?
You didn't know about that?
I had forgotten all about that.
Oh yeah, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, and we have direct fossil evidence of that, right? So that's not.
Oh yeah, we have huge fossils of insects, tons of them.
Yeah.
And they're scary looking stuff.
Yeah,
the fossil record actually kind of favors organisms with bony structures.
Yeah, some sort of hard something that is easier to fossilize properly, right?
It's earlier in the fossil record when we have a lot of these gelatinous creatures that we really don't know much.
Yeah, and may never.
Yeah.
Until we develop time travel.
It's been erased by time. And I don't think we're ever going back in time.
You know, can I just have a sidebar?
Sure.
Did you guys see the new X-Men?
I did.
Not yet.
You haven't seen it yet? Crap.
No, but I know what it's about. It's one of the better arcs in the comic series.
Well, the whole time travel thing is bugging me. It keeps being used as a theme in movies, and it just creates such absurdities. And I wanted to like the movie, but the time travel part just messed me up again.
It kind of ruined the new Star Trek for you too, didn't it?
Completely ruined the new Star Trek. Sci-fi keeps using time travel, and they keep screwing it up.
Well, it's a very convenient way to erase a timeline and give yourself a new platform.
Yeah.
Which is kind of what I think they're doing.
Well, they are, but it's kind of going to be a good thing for the X-Men franchise as far as that goes. In their defense, this arc that they're using has been around since, I think, like the 80s. So it's not like it was a recycled new idea or something like that. This was a rather old one as far as X-Men goes.
I think we got to do a new episode on sci-fi. Maybe we need to do like one episode a year on the year's science fiction.
Because this year in science fiction?
Yes.
That's a great idea.
So I'm upset. I really wanted to like this movie, and when the credits rolled, I was just sitting there like, what the hell were they thinking?
Yeah.
Anyway, sidebar, it'd be nice if we could travel back in time and see some of these organisms. It doesn't seem likely, and time travel pisses me off anyways.
Yeah.
That's it. I'm done. Nick, you can continue.
What were we talking about? This was a review on Cosmos?
Some show with some very lovely African-American guy.
He's quite handsome.
He's your personal astrophysicist, after all.
We should do a Depeche Mode version of that at the end.
I'm all for it. Well, the episode kind of opens up taking a look at the Earth of about 4 billion years ago. You know, that's when he's walking around with those insects. And it's how, you know, it would have been a really different world as far as we're concerned. I got to say, I kind of want one of those cosmic calendars. I think they were selling them.
Yeah, we should probably get one.
It just looks cool.
It would be nice to have a cosmic calendar.
I'm cool. Cheap, so I'll just download the JPEG, and I'll include it in my little series of JPEGs that flash on the computer when it goes into screensaver.
So, this is 4 billion years ago. I believe that's older than the oldest rocks that we found on Earth. I think the oldest rocks are around 3.5 billion years ago. Is that right?
I think so. I think he said, like, you know, the dinosaurs were still like 100 million years off at that point.
And so, you know, I mean, for me, one of the biggest questions that this episode brings up is a common question whenever I'm dealing with paleontology or geology. The most common question I come up with is, how do they know that? And so, you know, how do they know about animals that are older than the rocks that we've found? I mean, if they're older than the rocks that we've found, then obviously that means that we haven't found any fossils of those animals, because those fossils would be carried along in the cycle of the rocks that have gone away. So I'm assuming, I mean, if you would find a fossil of a certain age, that you would find rocks of that age. I mean, that just stands to reason. So how are they finding out about this stuff that is older than the rocks we know about? I don't know that.
Well, I don't think that we have any examples of life before the oldest rocks, because I think the oldest rocks are about 4 billion years old.
Right, but you're talking about the rocks that we've actually found. You know, we can date the Earth, and we already talked about that with a previous episode. You don't date the Earth by finding rocks. You date it by other methods. But if we actually haven't found any rocks of that age, then that would imply that we haven't found fossils of that age, in which case I'm wondering, how do they know all that stuff?
Well, there was no complex life 4 billion years ago, so we wouldn't have found fossils that we know of.
Right. They think that microbial life started around 4 billion years ago, right? 3 point something?
About 3.5 billion years ago.
Okay. So, yeah, I mean, that's just – I would assume that's somewhat speculatory.
Right. Well, I mean, he opens with a question saying, like, you know, at this time, those insects were able to get so big because there was so much oxygen in the air, almost like I think over twice the amount of oxygen in the air as there is at any point in the Earth's history.
Well, and that wasn't 4 billion years ago. That was 450 million years ago.
That was only 450 million? Because they talk about the rise of trees.
Yeah, that was not billions of years ago. That was hundreds of millions.
No, I'm not saying that the episode opens with the Earth already 4 billion years old.
Oh, I got you.
Yeah.
Okay, that makes sense. I thought 4 billion years. Okay.
Yeah. And so like, I wrote in my notes, this is whenever Earth is more like the forest moon of Endor, because we were the tree world, Norm. It's all Star Wars, Norm, with me.
Now, just to get my eras right, is this the Carboniferous era?
This is what led to it, essentially, because you have this rise of all these trees, and like, you know, the trees that the plant cells that made, what was it, lignin, that let the trees grow tall. And that was what I didn't realize. I didn't realize that there is nothing to make the trees decay, essentially, yet, because bacteria and other kind of decomposing organisms.
Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it?
Couldn't eat it. So you just had these trees that would die and fall.
And just lay there. Yeah.
This reminds me of modern plastic. We've bounded up all this carbon and plastic in landfills that bacteria can't break down. And it's kind of an interesting parallel.
Well, it's fascinating what happened to all all these trees. And so, like, normally you've got, you know, the trees giving off their oxygen. And then when they die, the organic matter mixes with the oxygen, gives off CO2 again. And as he put in there, at one point, Tommy said, it's kind of like balancing the books from a chemical level.
Yeah.
But we didn't have that yet. You know, the Earth's atmosphere instead was just piling up with lots and lots of oxygen. And instead of, you know, the carbon being released again into the atmosphere, you had instead of just being stored in the ground. And because the trees would get buried before they could decompose. And this had a pretty catastrophic effect on the planet, or at least on life. You know, because all those trees that decomposed, or that didn't decompose, rather, that were buried, it just becomes coal. Right. Giant deposits of it, too.
Right. And the thing I wanted to mention, Chalmer, earlier when you mentioned plastic, you know, one of the things that environmentalists don't emphasize is that, okay, so there's no microorganism to degrade plastic. Well, right now there isn't.
Right.
At some point, if the Earth had a lot of exposed plastic, or not even exposed, there's just a huge number of microorganisms in the soil. If that was a resource, then the evolution would be favored for creating something that exploited it.
Eventually, yeah. And we've actually looked at genetically creating bacteria capable of breaking it down.
Oh, that sounds like a terrible idea.
Engineering an enzyme.
That's like a Norm. That could be one of a sci-fi thing right there.
Definitely. Oh, yeah.
Definitely.
Well, Norm, I think as Ian Malcolm says, life finds a way.
Yes, it does. And, you know, I don't think that should be used as a get-out-of-jail-free card to just do whatever we want. But it has to be, you know, you have to temper your language when you say that, you know, this plastic is going to last for 10,000 years.
True.
Okay, well, you know, that you think that based on current what's currently going on, that might not be right. But
well, I'll say this, Norm. What you just said made me think of something I had thought of earlier in watching this.
That's so what I do.
You know, right now, plastic is still around right now, so nothing's feeding on it right now. When I was watching all these various planet Earths that they were going through in this episode, all I can think was is that there were plenty of times in history, matter of fact, most times in history, that the Earth wasn't quite fine-tuned for human beings to exist.
That is an understatement. I like that a lot. Not quite.
Well, there are a few times when it seemed like the Earth really hated life of any kind, except for the tardigrades, other than them.
I mean, yeah.
This massive deposit of coal.
Planet of the tardigrades.
Well, it led to the Permian extinction, and they brought back the Halls of Extinction, which I thought, you know, we thought was a pretty powerful.
The Great Dying, right?
Yeah, and that's what this was. I mean, you had volcanic activity heating up this giant, giant mass of coal. And I think we could probably see that in the rock, right, as a band. Is that how we know about that, Chalmer?
Say that one more time.
Well, the coal. Like, we would see the ash from all that burning, right, in the layers of rock. Would that be
one of the species? It's not just that. The volcanic activity in Siberia created the Siberian Traps, and it was one of the most significant volcanic events in geological history.
I think you said it lasted for, like hundreds of thousands of years, like this. There was so much coal, the whole atmosphere caught on fire. You had, you know, what was it like, you know, sulfuric acid rain. And I mean, it created like, you know, not only did you have poisonous fumes, in my notes I wrote down, this is whenever planet Endor became planet Mordor.
Yeah. Yeah. And it, I mean, it created a good third of Siberia.
And a lot of life couldn't live back then. It's because, you know, as Boromir says, Norm, one does not simply walk into Mordor.
Yeah, and there's this huge gap in the fossil record there where we see a whole lot of nothing.
Well, it was a double whammy, wasn't it? So it wasn't just the release of carbon. It was also that the atmosphere got damaged, and so ultraviolet radiation killed a lot of other stuff.
The ozone was destroyed.
Right.
And you had climate. Essentially, you know, I wrote my notes, you know, the climate changed too fast for life to adapt.
Yeah.
And 9 in 10 species didn't survive.
Yeah.
That's
so close to life on this planet being completely gone. It's insane.
It took 10 million years for life to recover.
That's crazy.
But yeah, biodiversity, 90% of that biodiversity just gone.
You know, about it, how completely egocentric is it for us to think that the planet is fine-tuned for our life?
Oh, yeah. Well, what's interesting is that in this case, it was an evolutionary change that helped kind of create this catastrophe.
Well, partially because of the layer of
coal.
Of coal, yeah, partially.
Well, this is one of those interesting things that, you know, like you can study, like, you know about this layer of coal and then know, but this episode and what it does, the series does for me in general, because we talked about before, what would we get out of it? Because we know a little bit more about this stuff, I think, than a lot of people might.
Right.
But what I don't do a lot of is connect the dots in ways. I mean, what I like about the idea of the cosmos, is studying the cosmos, is you're studying the whole thing. And so by studying this coal deposit that creates this Permian extinction, it that also alters the planet's atmosphere in such a way that other forms of life, including us, can one day come about.
Right.
It's that series of connecting the dots that I don't do a lot of. And so whenever the show does it for me, that continually is kind of awe-inspiring to me whenever I see some of these dots they connect.
I get you. Yeah.
So, you know, so even in an episode overall like this one where I knew a lot of the – a lot of the topics were more things I was much more familiar with. You know, I'd heard of Wegener and all that. I mean, I still find I'm getting a lot out of it just in the form of my mind being blown from right this, and not having ever connected those dots.
Sure. Remembering just how unlikely we are, not only on the, you know, universal scale, but on the scale of what's happened in on our own planet.
Yeah. And I know, you know, people –
at some point, the fact that things are so unlikely and weird that got us here, that if that's a plan, well, at some point a plan in that much chaos looks exactly like no plan.
Right. Yeah,
that's the beauty of the plan, Norm.
Ah, okay. Yeah,
and just a slight difference in any of this, and life would be completely different today.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's crazy. You know, that volcanic activity hadn't occurred, the living profile of today's ecosystems would be totally different.
Right. Well, for people,
nicely said.
If the planet is fine tuned for us, I mean, look at dinosaurs. They reigned for what, 170 million years?
Some large number.
So I feel like before we get to say that life is fine tuned for us, we have to outlive the dinosaurs.
At least, yeah. What do we got? About 200,000?
And even then, the tardigrades are like noobs. I mean, they don't.
We spent most of that wiping our ass with leaves.
You know what? I will allow tardigrades to be religious.
Yeah.
Yep. I'm okay with them being religious.
They are God's favored people.
That's right.
They are the microbial Jews.
I don't know. I think it's unjustified. Tardigrades are Jews.
For their modern Messiah.
I think there was a mistranslation.
Oh, we are getting much trouble right now.
Norm, it didn't bother me that the preachiness of this episode, a little bit of climate change.
I've heard tardigrades are frugal. Anyway.
No, they use their resources wisely.
And they don't mind the heat or something because they can live anywhere. So, oi, with the heat and the cold and the water.
Huge spring and jacket.
Huge discovery. All tardigrades are mysteriously circumcised.
Oh, my God. Well, there goes our Jewish demographic.
Yeah, it's gone.
Shalom, my friends. Moving on here. this is the first time Norman, the episode kind of mentioned climate change, and they, you know, it was kind of a theme that they ran through it with it. But I could see how you could find it a little preachy, but I think if you're,
oh, I don't really care. It's fine.
I mean, it was kind of still right.
It didn't bother me that it was preachy. It just made it to where it was a less interesting episode.
I'll
just for me,
that.
Because you know, again, I had nothing against it objectively. Just I didn't find it as entertaining for me personally.
I knew a good deal of it near the end.
Yeah.
But it's okay. No.
The thing about it, though, is you know, this recent 2 weeks ago, this announcement that large ice shelf is now on a, you know, inexorable path to dropping into the ocean, and that alone is going to raise sea levels by several feet. I think they've set up to 10 or something like that. You guys heard about this, right?
Well, yeah.
It's probably over like the next 200 years or more.
Right. So that's going to take quite a long time. But, go ahead, Chalmer.
On a geological time scale, it's all brief. But we think in such short terms that it seems inconsequential you know, we want everything to be within a year or so.
Right.
And climate doesn't really work that way.
No, and the thing is that I don't know. You guys know my position on this stuff. Yeah. 200 years, that's a good amount of time to figure it out.
Right.
True. I mean, you know, I think we probably should start changing the way we build, and we should not build buildings for, you know, that intend to stand for several hundred years. And I'm not sure most of the time we do anyways.
No, not really.
You know, we should move with the climate and with the planet and figure it out, you know.
Well, we're going to have to. I mean, like, you know, there won't really be a choice when it comes to it. So,
well, what's interesting to me is that still a lot of global warming deniers out there about carbon dioxide being a cause of global warming.
it's ridiculous. It's just ridiculous that anybody would deny that. I don't even understand. I mean, they don't have knowledge, apparently, of the mechanism and how obvious it is.
But what's interesting to me is that it was around the time of the Permian extinction, the CO2 in the atmosphere went up to about 2,000 parts per million. Right now, it's about 400 parts per million, and before the Industrial Revolution, it was around 200 parts per million.
Right.
I'm sure that's a coincidence.
Yeah, exactly. And
here's what I don't like about denier arguments. I hate whenever they say, hey, the Earth was warmer in the past. I say, yes, it was, but you might notice that that was one of those times when you don't find any human bones. There's a reason for that.
Right. But you didn't conclude your thought, Chalmer.
I got distracted.
Yeah.
Somebody came in the room. No, but just you can see during the Permian extinction, we have this huge increase in temperature associated with that 2,000 parts per million in the atmosphere. And we see an increase in global temperatures associated with the 400 parts per million.
Right.
And we can look back throughout history and we can see concentrations of CO2 in the atmosphere associated with heat.
And also then it has like that other swing where, like, you know, the sun, it gets blocked out from the coal smoke and, you know, you have freezing temperatures, like sub-freezing temperatures on the planet.
Yeah, and it changes circulation in the oceans, which changes the way that heat is distributed around the Earth. One of the problems is that if we screw up this pattern of heat distribution on Earth is that we can get places that get much, much colder because we're not distributing the heat that we get in the same way. So in some ways, it can actually fuel or seed an ice age. So it's a complicated problem.
Well, and I personally, and you tell me, you guys tell me if you think this is unreasonable. But my position on this is that we can't even predict the weather.
Yeah, exactly.
So as far as predicting the actual specific effects of global temperature, I'm skeptical of any specific claims.
I agree.
I personally take it as we're messing with something that is a kind of foundation of a number of cycles, life cycles and other natural cycles, heat cycles, atmospheric cycles. We're messing with something that is a foundation of many of these. And that leaves open to the possibility of lots of bad shit happening.
Mm-hmm. Right. That's kind of how I look at it, too. I think it's a pretty rational way of looking at it as saying, like, it's hard to predict what will happen.
Right.
But we know if you turn these knobs, things will happen.
But to me, it's all based on the actual heat created. It's not based on carbon dioxide in the atmosphere per se. Carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, if it, for example, it didn't raise the heat of the atmosphere or it didn't actually raise the global temperature, there's no other significant ill effects of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. It's not like, you know, there's too much as in there's too much for life. Life actually does use carbon dioxide. So the heat is the problem. And we've already talked about this before. There are ways that we can speculate right now that we can actually control the temperature of the planet, you know, turn up the air conditioning on the planet, so to speak, intentionally.
But we talked about this in our geoengineering episode, which I think was one of our...
I think it was our first one, actually.
Very first.
Might have been. And so to me, that's something that we have to figure out. And if we already have ideas, a number of ideas that people aren't saying, well, that's implausible, then to me, this is not something that troubles me very much. It's something that troubles me politically, because I wonder if people will get their act together and actually do something to control the plant, the temperature. Controlling carbon, as we've talked about before, I just think that you know, forget it. It's gotten away with us already.
Yeah.
Well, I'll just one more note on it, in that I agree. Like, for me, the thing that bothers me, I suppose, about deniers is that I don't like people who use poor reasoning. And so a lot of the reasons for denying this is just poor reasoning.
Absolutely.
That bothers me more than what the potential ramifications might actually be, given the timescales involved. I just don't like people who are thinking irrationally whenever there are good reasons instead that you could be using.
What worries me about it is it's politically influential. And any solution, including a solution that intentionally lowered the temperature of the planet, would require some political will to do it, because, you know, you can't just do it as a private company. You're talking about, you got to, you know, get governments together. You've got to coordinate, and you're dealing with, you know, regulations. So it has to have the political backing. And right now, that would be a real problem because of this bad thinking and it translating into, you know, people having basically conspiracy theories that climate change is an economic kind of thing that liberals want to start companies. I mean, some of the stuff that's basically a lot of the stuff that's out there.
You're bringing me down.
It's absurd.
You know, let's go back to Cosmos here. The next thing they talk about was the Guadalupe mountain range, and Neil calls it the world's largest fossil reef.
Yeah.
I love looking at those formations like that out there in places like Utah and that sort of thing, places that, you know, the wonderful geology and the way those rocks look. It's just fantastic.
Where is the Guadalupe Reef?
I think it starts someplace in, I don't know. I can just make something up, but I almost wrote that down and decided not to. It's a 400-mile range. You know, we're talking about forming about 275 million years ago. We see a lot of those fossils in there, and a lot of like the chemicals from like those organic compounds found in the bands of rock.
It looks like it's
Texas.
Texas, yeah.
Oh wow.
Well, I guess that's one good thing about Texas.
we've been looking for years.
I lived in Texas for 10 years, by the way, so I have license to make fun of Texas.
Okay.
Then you escaped.
Yes, I drove in one direction for way too long and eventually left Texas.
Was asked to leave.
Yeah, I'm looking at a map of Texas right now, and what I did not realize is that Carlsbad Caverns is a cave system that's in the reef in the Guadalupe Mountains, which is a cave that I've actually been to and walked around in.
Yeah, me too.
That's cool.
But this huge reef, it actually curves around. It looks just like a real reef that you'd find in the ocean.
Yeah.
It's enormous, though.
Yeah.
There's a reason for that.
Can you imagine being a geologist back before plate tectonics and just discovering this stuff and being completely baffled?
Yeah.
I just think that would have been an awesome time to be a geologist.
Seriously, how the...
I'm in Texas, and this is a reef. What the fuck?
Yeah.
I imagine you probably...
Are you guys seeing this?
You probably wouldn't believe your data, kind of, like, and wouldn't want to tell people, like, I think I saw, like, it looked like a fossil of, like, some kind of oceanic creature.
Yeah, okay. I mean, it just, that must have been... I just think that being a scientist when you're right in the middle of figuring out something big, that would be just a really...
It's gonna screw with your head.
Yeah, and that would... If you have the right attitude, which I think most scientists do have the right attitude about that kind of thing, that's where wonder is, right?
Right. Oh yeah. Well, speaking of the beginning of something big, the episode goes to 1570 with Abraham Ortelius.
Yeah.
He created the first modern world atlas.
Yeah, but he was the first person, the first dude, apparently, to do that. But he did subscribe to the idea that the land masses fit together, correct?
He created that. He looked at his map.
Well, no, I mean, it goes back to before him, doesn't it?
I don't know. If he was the first person who created that atlas, he might have been one of the first people who had a picture big enough to look at and say, it looks like these pieces of a puzzle might fit.
Right.
And I think he speculated.
He might have been the first. I think he might have been the first person to actually, you know, like scientifically state it. But I think that there is some history of others who have made this.
Abraham Ortelius put forward the idea that the continents may have drifted in 1596.
Right.
He thought maybe like earthquakes and floods may have taken them apart from each other.
I don't know if he thought that. I think he simply said drift. I think Alfred Wegener was the first one to actually have a theory.
That's where the series goes next. It takes us to, he was, I think, what, in World War I, he was wounded. He was fighting the Germans and recovered in a hospital, started studying, you know, geology, studying the planet.
And he put forth the idea in 1912.
Well, he created the concept of Pangaea.
Right.
The supercontinent.
According to the Wikipedia page on continental drift, Abraham Ortelius was the first person to actually note that the continents seem to fit together.
Although there is an illustration by Antonio Snyder Pellegrini from 1858 as well that shows a supercontinent.
Well, again, Ortelius is 1596, so that's way before any of these fuckers.
Well, I know, but speaking of Pangaea and a supercontinent.
Oh, yeah.
So Alfred Wegener couldn't have been the first to have done that.
Well, what Wegener realized, or one of the things that made him consider this was, Neil says his evidence was the Earth itself, because he's looking at, you know, scientists had this weird problem of having, you had fossilized ferns showing up in two different continents that were now extinct, or dinosaur bones appearing on two different continents.
Yeah.
Separated by all that distance, and the conventional wisdom was, well, there must have been some kind of land bridge, like maybe a mountain range that eventually got swallowed up by the ocean. And that didn't make a lot of sense to him. He didn't think that would be how it would work.
Right.
He was looking at actual evidence, not just shapes and sort of.
Right. And he was also looking at, like, you know, you would dig up rocks and look at the bands in the rock, and it would match exactly the bands on the other side of the planet.
Right.
And that seemed weird to him, you know. And also something he was looking at was, well, you know, even if there were land bridges, how do you get up way up in Iceland tropical fossils?
And, you know, even though he had this evidence, right, he was ridiculed. His ideas were not taken seriously.
Even like worse Neil than not says that, like, you know, so he was the toast of the scientific world, right?
Not at all.
Yeah. Everyone thought he was an idiot.
I kind of understand that reaction, because this really is a counterintuitive thing. I mean, you look at the Earth, you can just walk around, you look at the mountains, and it's very hard to imagine that they are moving in such drastic ways. Right. Because it's very hard to contemplate the scale of time and the mechanisms that work on that scale.
Right. Yeah, because a lot of this drift, it happens in centimeters per decade.
Yes, and I am going to, you guys know I'm going to Iceland in 2 weeks. So I'm going to take several pictures of myself standing in one of the places where the plates rip apart.
Yeah, one of the places they rip apart very quickly.
Yeah, it's moving, I think, a foot a year or something like that.
Yeah, it's crazy. You can actually see, it's just a crack in the earth. It's pretty nuts.
Yeah.
And I hiked the fault before in New Zealand. We were hiking someplace. You could see a clear tear right down the valley.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's crazy.
Yeah, we like walked right over it.
Did you get any pictures?
I did not. I think that was my at one point on that trip, I had a close encounter with a river where I fell in it a little too hard, and the camera was destroyed.
Seriously?
Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah, well, that was a fun day.
There went your career as a geologist.
I know. You know, Norma, talks about here, he says, you know, scientists are human too, you know, and we all have our blind spot and biases. And we kind of, you kind of talked about it earlier, you know,
they have feelings.
Right. You know, and it, now he says the good thing about science as a process is that it corrects for that eventually.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the whole point.
And that's probably what makes it such a powerful enterprise. Probably one of the most powerful tool we have for examining the physical world is that it has these self-correcting mechanisms in it.
Right.
But that was one of them. And then, you know, once again, another female scientist who was, not being given her due, Mary Thorpe in 1952 is where they go.
Right.
And I think it was someone gave her this sonar map of they use sonar to map the ocean floors and is told her to essentially do something with it, probably to keep her busy. And, you know, using that, she was able to discover a gigantic rift in the Atlantic Ocean.
Right. And how, again, this is one of those moments where I just think, how excited would you be when you first see that image?
Well, it's hard to say. Normally you would think, how excited would she be, followed by how like depressing would it be to have, like, you know, the male counterparts of the day just dismiss it out of hand as, like, you know, crazy girl talk, I think the guy said in the episode. I mean, that sort of thing bothers me.
I almost find it hard to believe that he said crazy girl talk. that seems a little unrealistic. Because I don't feel like that's a feminine stereotype.
What? Talking about the
more modern speak or what?
Talking about the ocean floor? Yeah.
Yeah.
That's not really the stereotype.
That's not lady stuff. No. It's stupid. That was the one line where my suspension of disbelief was just shattered.
He looked at her and said, "Come on, Mary, don't make me LOL."
Yeah.
Get out there with the crazy girl talking.
Did he actually say that? No, he didn't.
In the episode, he did.
He said, "Don't make me LOL."
No, he didn't say that.
No, he didn't.
I wouldn't have been able to continue. That would have been too much.
You know, maybe he could add a little more humor because he's a pretty funny guy. You and I, everybody, us three have seen him in various YouTube clips of him, you know, talking with science groups and skeptic groups and talking on interviews and TV programs, and he can be really funny.
Yeah. I actually wonder how much of the words he got the right for himself to say in a way that makes sense for him. I've been wondering this a lot as I've been watching this, because Carl Sagan, you know, he wrote, you know, with Adrian and Steve Soder, like, they wrote the original. And so obviously Carl knows how he speaks and can actively take a hand in shaping the script to a way that's going to make sense for him to say it.
Right.
Well, Soder wrote a great deal of this one too, right?
He did. Well, he kind of was responsible for like the science content, and, you know, Anne was more about putting like the kind of like the heart and soul and why it matters into it. Is kind of how they divided the labor. Mm-hmm. And Neil said before that he was in the writer's room at first with them, but then that they seemed to have a pretty good grasp on it, and that he felt it was kind of too many, you know, cooks in the kitchen, and just kind of let them write it. Right, so I was always kind of wondering, you know, like, did they come to him and say, is it okay if we write it this way? Could you say it this way? Or would you rather say it this way? I kind of wonder, like, you know, if he reworked any of it to say in a way that, you know, is more Neil.
He seems like he's pretty, like the lines are pretty planned. It doesn't seem spontaneous to me. It
seems very scripted, yeah.
So, and you know, that has pluses and minuses. So I would say that he's probably not adding much, but...
That's right.
Back on the whole girl talk point, there is one historical component to the work of Mary Tharp that what is, you know, genuinely sexist, and it's that at the time, women were not allowed to travel on the oceans doing scientific research.
Oh, wow!
So they thought it was too dangerous, or they didn't. They probably actually also thought that it. Wasn't a good environment for them because they would be surrounded by too many men on a closed ship. That was the kind of stuff, that's the kind of reasoning that people used to have back then.
That was very old nautical thought.
Yes, and a little hint of, you know, if you're a woman and you're around, isolated on your own and around a lot of men, that you're asking for it. Yeah. I mean, that's kind of common thinking back then. So it's kind of disgusting, but that was the reality at the time.
You still see it today, unfortunately.
Yeah, you do, I guess.
A little too common.
It's terrible. Yeah. But
well, you know, here's another cool thing about science is how, like, we have like, you discover this evidence, this sonar evidence of this gigantic rift down there.
Yeah.
And she says, look at this thing. And he's like, I don't know. That sounds like continental drift. You don't want to be, you know, people will ridicule you the same way they ridiculed Wegener. You don't want to do this.
Right.
But then later on, years later, they have this more evidence of they're mapping seismographs and seismographic activity on the ocean floor. And they lay that seismographic map out on top of the one that she had drawn out years before.
And it matches.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It matches exactly down the river. And that was a smoking gun.
Yeah.
And that vindicated Alfred Wegener.
Yeah.
And I think that would have been like that to me would have been like that great moment where finally, like, this idea you've had for years, that feeling of vindication and finding that proof, that's probably a fantastic feeling.
Was Wegener alive when this happened?
No, I don't think so. I think the episode kind of showed that he had died, right, and on an expedition. He kind of
1930, yeah, long before.
Yeah, I mean, putting it all together wasn't until the 70s, right?
Was it really the 70s? Jeez.
It may have been. Yeah, because, because she first looked at this, she first made that map in 1952. And I know they said it was years later that they had the sonar graphs to kind of put on top of it.
Right.
You know, I just love that kind of, you know, the way science works with building evidence and building evidence. And I think sometimes people take for granted how hard it
1960s.
Is to get a scientific 60s, theory.
Yeah. And before we get too far afield, think about how recent that is.
Yeah.
How recent it is that we have knowledge of the ocean floor and correlating that with seismic activity and being able to put all the pieces of the puzzle together to actually support not only the idea of continental drift, which indicates that the continents were linked, but together with the fact that what is the mechanism that causes that plate tectonics.
Right.
It's crazy. When my grandfather was my age, this was not even the scientific consensus.
No.
He wouldn't have even heard of it.
No. And that's one of the things I love about plate tectonics. It just makes sense of just a huge number of things.
Yeah.
And like it's not.
It has.
Yeah. Just from, you know, life on the planet, how life got to various places, all kinds of things that aren't even related necessarily directly to geology.
Right. Well, we know about the expansion of the universe before we knew about this.
Isn't that crazy?
Yeah, we knew about other galaxies.
We're still discovering species on this planet all the time.
Speaking of that, that's where the episode goes. They take the ship of the imagination and they go deep, right down into the Marianas Trench.
Yeah.
And they said something awesome here. More people have been on the surface of the moon than have been down there.
Yeah.
Think about that. Okay, I mean, that's amazing. The Mid-Atlantic Ridge, the largest submerged mountain range on the planet.
Yep.
I mean, the Marianas Trench itself is the deepest canyon on the planet. It's over 10 kilometers deep.
Yeah.
So who knows, how deep is the Grand Canyon?
I don't know. It's
like a mile?
Yeah.
This dwarfs that.
I don't even know if it's a mile deep. Yeah, I'd be surprised if it was a mile.
I think it's right around a mile. Check, but the deepest portion of the Mariana Trench is 6.85 miles.
Ridiculous.
That is ridiculous.
That's higher than Denver is above sea level.
That's like let me think.
As usual, Chalmer is right. The depth it attains is about 6,000 feet, just a little bit over a mile.
That's a mile is about a 1 minute free fall. So that means if you were to get at the highest point of the Mariana Trench and jump, you would fall at terminal velocity for a good 6.5 minutes. That is nuts.
Brings to mind that comedian's joke about falling off of a tall building. That you jump and then you're so scared and you yell, but you know, you're going to be falling for a while, so you're going to yell and then you're going to take a little break and breathe, and then you're going to yell again.
Sounds like Bill and Ted's Bogus Adventure.
And I've been skydiving, and that 1 minute, you know, you're booking.
Yeah.
It's a fast ride.
Yeah. You know, I had a conversation with a philosopher friend of mine recently, and I was trying to, the conversation drifted over beers toward, you know, how useless philosophy, in as far as the actual industry or academic field of philosophy is. And, I was talking about how, you know, probably 99 point whatever percent of the quote unquote philosophical research that goes on, if it didn't happen, the earth would be completely unchanged. Nothing about society or anything would be different. And and I said, you know, science just doesn't have this problem, and that's one of the reasons why I'm really excited about moving my career in from philosophy to science. And he said, well, what about people who are just discovering species, cataloging species of insects? I mean, really, who cares? And I thought, you know, I don't agree with that.
I don't either.
I mean, are there lots and lots of these species? And, you know, any one species, it might be just, okay, that's interesting. Sure, but you know what? Putting all of that data together, you know, one of the things about this episode that it shows is how you can put a lot of different things together to draw interesting conclusions. I mean, that's seen time and time and time and time again. Oh, yeah. In science.
Or adding resolution to our account of the world.
Right.
Well, science, you know, science a lot of times deals with the tangible, real stuff.
Right.
So it's going to be more, you know, exciting in some ways, I suppose, than just, I mean, it's philosophy. A lot of times it's just words.
Right. You know, but it's pure, you know, speculation.
Right.
You know. I don't know. I have mixed feelings about that as well, because he made the point that all that pure speculation does lead to important things as well. And yeah. I don't know. I told him that I thought the last important work of philosophy was John Rawls back in the 70s. That there has been interesting philosophy since then, but there hasn't been anything important.
Yeah.
And he at the moment, I mean, I kind of put him on the spot. At the moment, he couldn't come up with an example to say that I was wrong. But I don't know. That's a separate debate. I think that it is strange that there are a lot of species on this planet that we don't know anything about. A lot of areas on the planet that are kind of still mysterious to us.
Well, it's hard to go. The pressure down there in the Marianas Trench is 8 tons per square inch.
Right.
So that's hard to go down there.
We clearly need better scanning.
Yeah.
We need better scanning from lots of different positions, right? I mean, right now you go into the airport security and they have to do a kind of uncomfortable body scan, which turns into a visual image. It really should just be a series of sensors that detects for certain materials. It doesn't do it need a shape. You don't need a shape, just detect for certain materials. And, you know, if you can sense things like that at a distance, then you don't need to actually go to the bottom of the ocean floor. You can just send equipment down there and start cataloging the kinds of things that you find. So we need better... We need better sensors. We need better detection equipment.
Well, they're working on it. I mean, what's cool is you still find such a variety of life down there in such a harsh environment.
Right. Yeah.
There's no sunlight. There's no photosynthesis down there happening at all.
Right.
No plants.
Right.
You know, and but you still have, like, life is feeding on the hydrogen sulfide.
Yeah, it's the chemicals that come out of the vents. Yeah, the vents.
And it's one of the things that we think might, you know, like, you know, they talk about, like, could life exist other places in the universe? There's places on Earth that seems like it doesn't want life to be there, but it's still there.
Yeah, life kind of shouldn't exist. That should be a good episode of I Shouldn't Be Alive.
Well, and there's it's kind of a bias in the way that we think about life.
Right.
The idea that light would be the only source, but really anywhere where we have a sort of disequilibrium, or we have a process that could be exploited for energy, there is a potential for life.
Like a concentration gradient.
You just need a systematic means of exploiting it, whether that's a complex biomolecule or a means of pushing that gradient further, something like that. You have the potential for a living system.
I'm offended. Cool. I just used a cool chemistry term, and Chalmer didn't react at all.
You did. It was nice. It was well stated.
I was hurt.
I'm sorry.
Well, in the chemistry circle, it's so commonplace, Norm. I mean, what do you want?
Yeah, I use that word 8 times a day, man.
Good for you. Good for you. I thought it was cool to the idea that someday those underwater mountain ranges may rise above the surface of the ocean, given the way the plate tectonics work.
Sure.
Well, we've had volcanoes peak the surface of the ocean in the last decade.
Yeah, and then you'll have stupid climbers die on the tops of those mountains instead of Everest.
Yeah, good for them.
The important thing, Norm, is that there are always new places for stupid human beings to die.
You guys heard the news, like, again, it was almost, I guess, 3 weeks ago or something like that, a month ago, that there was just a terrible incidence of a bunch of climbers dying on Mount Everest, and so they just canceled the whole thing.
The deadliest season of it, yeah. All the Sherpas were unnerved by how many people, even. I mean, it was...
Yeah, and Laura and I have seen documentaries about these climbers, and we you know, almost every 10 minutes, we end up looking at each other and thinking, why do these idiots do this?
Yeah.
I'm interested in it.
Did you see that
climbing Everest?
The idea of climbing something that's hard and going someplace like that, yeah. Yeah, that's an interesting idea.
Come on, dude. I think you're equivocating on the term hard. Because it's one thing to climb a hard mountain. It's another thing to, you know, have a very real risk of dying. Not from the climbing aspect, but from the things like lack of oxygen and cold.
Yeah. Sudden weather changes. It's completely beyond control.
That's why I'm not interested in going to do it. But I understand why people want to go do it.
Yeah, I can kind of see the appeal.
I don't.
I'm into nature, and I'm into doing hikes and going places and seeing things like that. And
I
get the appeal of it.
I guess I do get the appeal. When I say I don't understand it, what I mean is I don't understand it being rational for people to do that.
I don't know. I mean, it's one of those things where it doesn't add to society. So you could say, is it rational for people to chase tornadoes? Well, I guess you could say it might add to our scientific knowledge of tornadoes, so maybe. But it's still a pretty dangerous thing to do.
I would say the desire to do it is irrational.
It is not even close to as dangerous to chase tornadoes than it is to climb Everest. Not even close.
I didn't say it was, but it's still two dangerous activities.
Yeah.
Did you guys see the episode of Family Guy where Brian pees on the top of Mount Everest and all the dogs in the world just know?
Yeah, he was like, they'll know.
Where is this episode going?
This episode has lots of layers, Norm. Just
it
like,
does.
And that's what they talk about next. Look at that segue. Chalmer, the crust of the Earth in proportion is about as thick as the skin of an apple.
Oh, yeah. I've
heard that before, and that's kind of crazy, isn't it?
It's scary.
Like everything that we know, everything that we could think of, like the deepness even of the oceans and all that, skin of an apple.
It's a thin silicate crust laced with iron and aluminum and oxygen, and that's about it.
I got to say, Norm, I loved the shot, the overhead shot of the dinosaur killer asteroid coming in, like from the ship of imagination.
The sound, too. That scene was just really well done.
I just wrote my notes, fucking awesome.
Yeah.
Well, not for the dinosaurs so much, but for us.
When these huge asteroids hit, they're not just leaving – they don't really leave a crater. They leave a pool. There are impact craters in Canada that filled in with the molten rock and actually separated out into constituent metals and just created a lake of molten lava that then dried and separated. And some of these places are now mines. Because it concentrated all the various aspects of the metals.
Sure.
Kind of the way you would in a crucible when you melt rock and it separates out into its constituents.
Sure.
It punches a hole in the crust.
Right.
It's not a crater. It's a wound.
Right.
And it's a global one. Whenever you look at like the shot of it from space, like what it would look like is dramatic and very dramatic. I mean, it's insane. And it was this leads to the dawn of the planet of the mammals. You know, and which is good for us. So,
one of the points that was made is it's even more narrow. The success of our species is even more narrow than that, because after the mammals started, you know, to flourish because of the various extinctions, there were still elements that had to occur. Things that had to occur in order for primates to evolve, and then in order for primates to become more diversified. Like one of the points was made that there were fewer trees because of the atmosphere, I believe.
Well,
yeah.
If a continental drift changed the ocean current. This is the part of the episode that blew my mind.
Me too. I had yeah.
Again, this is like I'm saying. Like I knew about continental drift coming in. I also knew that ocean currents affect climates. I knew those two things.
Right.
It never occurred to me to link the two together. That if you have continental drift and it changes the ocean currents and that changes the planet's temperature and that creates, instead of a tropical rainforest in North Africa, you have a savanna all of a sudden.
Yeah. Fewer trees.
Right.
And so there's a greater distance between them.
Right. But look at that, what that forces life to do to adapt to it.
Right.
How that drives our evolution blew my mind all over the ceiling. It was ridiculous.
What's
crazy to me is the specific geological change they associated with this reduction of trees was cutting off of the Atlantic from the Pacific by means of the Panama region. That connects North and South America. It's a tiny little swath of land that just kind of came up and blocked off these two oceans, and it changed an entire continent.
Yep.
That's just nuts to me.
The primates ended up having to get on the ground and couldn't take shelter in the trees, swinging from tree to tree anymore. And so they had to adapt to competing with the other animals that were on the ground. And in being on the ground, it favored walking upright instead of, using your arms and legs to swing. And so we had these well-developed arms from, basically, again, evolution stacking systems upon systems and only changing when it really needs to be changed. So we had these really great tools, arms, that we didn't know what to do with anymore. We find a way to exploit that,
right.
As in using them to make weapons and other tools, because they're free, and that leads to the development of a big brain to increase the advantage of that, and now you get on the direction of us.
It's kind of an odd coincidence to me is that we eventually used our ingenuity to create the Panama Canal
to close it off again.
It's crazy to me.
It is ironic. Was there something?
There
is something here in the episode I did not know about. I didn't realize the effect of the gravitational pull of other planets like Venus and Jupiter has on Earth.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, yeah.
That was new information for me as well.
And that also kind of blew my mind a bit. That was just crazy.
I knew about that.
Earth's orbit a little tiny bit, you get a giant ice age.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And then you've got organisms that have to adapt to those kinds of changes over time.
Right.
Even without the gravitational influence of the other planets, we do have that tilt doesn't stay constant. It teeters back and forth.
Well, whose fault is that?
Well, actually, it's not as bad as it would be because we have the moon. But on planets like Mars, I don't remember the exact time span, if it's over 100,000 years or over 2 million years. But its north pole will more and more face the sun.
Huh.
And it will stay that way and then eventually move back a little bit to where it is now.
Right.
And it teeters back and forth between those that tilt.
Like a top that is wobbling, right?
Exactly. That's a perfect metaphor for it.
Or like a dreidel. Dreidel. To tie it back in.
A tardigradel.
Oy vey.
A tardigradel. A tardigrade on the roof.
Yeah. Sorry, what were we talking about?
I don't even remember anymore.
Man. Well, the episode then kind of closes on global warming. And this is probably whenever we started to know a lot more of what they were talking about,
right.
I suppose. But it was okay, though. I mean, I loved his line, the dinosaurs never saw the asteroid coming. So what's our excuse? I don't care if it's preachy. It's kind of true, okay? I mean, these are things that people are saying these are going to happen. And now, arguably you have the effects of climate change showing up in today's day and age. I don't want to say I told you so to deniers, but we told you so. God damn it. I mean.
Well, with asteroid impacts and comets and stuff, comets we see, but asteroids, we have these observatories looking for them now and trying to catalog them, but even still, they can come out of nowhere. Right. And really, if one surprises us in the next, oh, I'd say 50 to 100 years, tough shit. We're screwed. I don't think that we have the technology to deal with it for at least another 50 to 100 years.
You guys remember that when that news of that ice sheet inexorably falling came out, that I posted something on Facebook saying, well, you know, it's nice to live here in Colorado at No Mile High.
Yeah.
My response was that we could change our name to the Mile High Sea Level Project.
That's right. I mean, you know, look, these kinds of changes are going to have effects on a large scale, possibly. I think we'll probably figure things out along the way. There might be some disastrous, I think there might be some isolated disasters, which how is that really different from normal life on this planet?
Yeah.
You know, it really is about starting to engineer the planet to be more friendly and then engineer how we live on it to also make it more friendly. So, I'm obviously for reducing carbon and
– Because those are natural disasters and natural things are good.
Right. Natural equals good.
This made me think of something you had told me, Norm, I think leading up to the debate you did, which was that a lot of times when people are denying an idea – they're denying it based on an ideology. They're trying to support a worldview of their own.
And it's an ideology that often they don't even realize, let alone actually have justified.
Right. Yeah. Well, here's the thing. People who are denying global warming and climate change, it's not because they don't believe the science. It's because they're afraid that if it's true, then socialism is true. That's what it is. It all comes down to that. It's that, you know, it's because Al Gore is rich. And therefore, global warming is wrong, and he supports, you know, public health care for everyone. It always connects into these weird ideas that are completely unconnected to the science of it.
They've shown that the psychology of conservatism is actually associated with a kind of isolationist psychology in terms of social issues. That it's very much mine and theirs. It's a groupthink kind of.
Yeah.
It cultivates a groupthink attitude.
It's a real shame that it has, because it is a scientific issue. It's not a political issue.
Yeah.
And I'm glad to see some Republicans seemingly more Republicans starting to be on board and say this isn't a partisan issue. This is something that we have to take seriously.
Yeah.
So I don't know. The two-party system, that's a whole another discussion.
Well, Neil says in the episode, like, do we want to continue on our path that we're on now, you know, We're making the Earth's atmosphere a little bit more like it was during the time of the dinosaurs,
right?
Which wasn't good for mammals,
right?
And what's our excuse for doing that? And this is one of those things where people have a hard time looking at the long scale when it comes to time involved in things, and I understand that, and I do. I have the same problem, but I loved how the episode ended with talking about the Halls of Extinction and that unnamed corridor. You know, right. Is it going to say the Great Human Extinction in there? I mean. It's unnamed, and something's going to go there probably someday. Probably no matter what, even no matter, like, the best case scenario is that I can see the, you know, all life as we know it today being gone, you know, eventually. Can you?
One way or another.
Yeah. So, I mean, unless
we I don't know if I can.
Unless we learn to live off planet, I can easily see us not being able to survive.
I don't know if I can, because of the varieties of ways that life is tenacious on this planet already.
I mean all life.
Oh, you said life as we know it on this planet.
There are no more dinosaurs today, but they lived for 170 million years. They had a pretty good run. You know, I don't even know if we're going to make it that long as human beings.
Oh, okay. I guess I just didn't know what you meant. I think that it would be very, very difficult to get rid of life on this planet completely.
I think so.
Well, it's inevitable eventually. The planet,
of course, of course.
But yeah, I think if we move forward 100 billion years, life would not be – we wouldn't recognize it as it is today. We might see common themes and forms and things like that, but the plants we would have found 100 million years ago, the animals we would have found, we would have found parallels, but we wouldn't have found anything – identical. It's a constant fluid system changing.
Well, you'd still find GMO corn.
Yeah, of course. Yeah,
but even in the future, Norm, you would still be Monsanto. So
it's really permanent. Yeah, Monsanto is forever.
You know, the toward the end of the episode, something that that Neil deGrasse Tyson said, I thought was really a neat way of putting it, that the, you know, this is the earth of our moment. And that, you know, the earth is constantly changing. So is life on the planet. It's changing in almost every way you can imagine. The temperature, the rock, the landscape features, the ocean floor, the depth of the ocean, the temperature of the planet, the currents, the composition of the atmosphere varies, level of radiation, the axis, the pole, magnetic poles. I mean, the list could go on. I mean, so, you know, you look around and you think things are stable, and that's just because that's the brief look that we have.
Well, you know, they say, you know, look, this interglacial period that we're in now, it's probably going to last another 50,000 years before the Earth tilts again in such a way that you might have another big ice age.
Right.
It's going to happen.
Right.
It's just the kind of the way physics works. And it's kind of amazing that we can know those things, you know. And
I'm ready because I live right near a Burlington coat factory. So
let's get a parka. I don't know what you guys are complaining about. God. Yeah,
it's not a big deal.
I wrote my notes, Norm, that, you know, right now life is fine tuned for us right now.
Yeah. So the anthropic principle applies really easily there.
And it always seems to apply in the moment, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And if you want to get preachy about it, you can say this is why things like, you know, climate change are important to at least think about, because mm-hmm. you don't want to change that tuning in a way that's not ideal for us.
Yep.
So,
I mean, what are the odds that our three computers and mic setups would be so perfectly aligned so as to allow this podcast to occur over the internet? That's amazing.
It's all part of the plan, the tardigrade plan. So, and then we trust Norm. I think that was a live tardigrade they showed in this episode at the very end.
Yeah.
It looked like it. Yeah. That was a live picture of it.
Yeah.
They say if you read the DNA of a tardigrade, you see your own future.
I wonder if there are tardigrades in my coffee.
Probably.
Those little guys, man.
Well, by ingesting them, you gain their power.
I still want to talk about the X-Men. But we'll have to do another episode.
Why don't we wrap up this episode here? You know, I wrote down the last line of the episode because I felt it was a powerful one. Neil says, what happens here in countless ways, both large and small, is being written by us right now.
Yeah.
And that's powerful. It's true. And I think it's something important for everyone to consider. This was episode number nine. And I loved it. I love all of them. I don't care what you say, Norm.
I got you.
You're just upset at X-Men. It's colored you. So it's distorted it.
I think I like the episode the next Cosmos better.
Right.
But we'll save any discussion of that for our episode.
Oh, yeah. The next one was very good.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, we'll be back for that. Norm, I hope you get to be here for some of those ones. I know you're going to be traveling abroad here, so we'll see.
Maybe we can record before I leave. I leave about... Well, almost exactly 1 week from today. So
let's do it then.
Do one episode before I leave. And
sometime next week, we'll try and get it in here for you guys. But, you know, this Cosmos series is drawing to a close. I love it. I love again, for me, it's the dots that it connects. Even on an episode like this that I knew a lot about, it connects the dots in ways I never thought of. And the cosmos is so beautiful when you study it.
Yeah.
And it's awe-inspiring to me. I love it. And I'm very excited that we've had this series so far. I've really enjoyed doing this series so far with you guys. It's been better than I thought it was going to be for me.
And you know what this kind of stuff makes me want to do, and this is an idea I want to share with you guys, actually, because I know it's sometimes hard for us to get together, but I would like for us to have maybe once a year a science outing where we volunteer with some local project. You know, we're right near Dinosaur Ridge.
Oh, I love it.
And we have this show. Maybe that would give us a little bit of legitimacy to have an official visit where we can actually, you know, we can actually dig up some fossils, or we can actually help out in some way and maybe document or podcast about it afterwards. And there are a lot of projects going on in Colorado,
oh, yeah.
Not only in the environmental science community, which is big here, but also in the, you know, paleontology community and zoology community.
there's a lot of stuff through the Denver Museum of Nature and Science.
Yeah.
We're doing all these things, just so you guys know. So congratulations, Norm. You just made a whole lot more work for us.
Well, you know, I mean, I think that's something that would be worthwhile. We should, you know, get out of our comfy offices and get out in the field a little bit more, you know?
I agree. That would be fun.
So, yeah, we're going to work on that.
Okay. Well, everyone, thank you for listening today. It's been awesome. I hope you enjoyed our little foray through the lost worlds of the planet Earth. Remember, in the tardigrade we trust. Please. Please, guys. I'm telling you. Think responsibly.
There's always been laughing, crying, birth and dying, boys and girls with hearts that take a give and break, a heal and grow and recreate and raise and nurture, but then hurt from time to time like these, in times like those, what will be, and so it goes. There will always be stop and go and fast and slow and action, reaction, and sticks and stones and broken bones, those for peace and those for war and